Session number 9173, reel 10.
John Medaway, tape 10. Do you think, Mr. Medaway, that the Field Marshal's two-year period can be considered a sort of stage, a separate stage in the Cyprus emergency? I know the danger is that one periodizes too tightly, but when you look back upon the emergency, do you think of it in that way at all?
Yes, I think you can fairly regard it as, so to speak, the end of a chapter. He'd completed the period of 2 years, which he'd agreed to serve as governor in Cyprus, and during that period he had succeeded in what he regarded as his main task, the restoration of law and order in the island. Eoka had been fought pretty well to a standstill at that stage, and there had been very little violence for some months then. Of course, the menacing thing was that Eoka had spent that time reorganizing and re-equipping itself, we had, the British had succeeded merely in scotching the snake, not killing it. But there were encouraging signs. The Greek government was showing a greater disposition to try and reach a compromise, although in rather feeble a fashion. The Cypriots were getting pretty fed up and tired of the whole emergency, and so I think one could say that considerable progress up to that time had been reached. But while it was the end of a chapter, it was also, in a sense, the beginning of a new, because the Field Marshal left his mark on the new chapter. By that I mean that his thinking on the subject of the final solution of the problem had taken root. He'd come round, as I told you, I think, to the conclusion that there was no hope of a settlement and peace and progress in Cyprus unless the twin bugbears of Enesis and partition were first ruled out, and then having done that, there might be a chance of a compromise and getting the Cypriots to take part in self-government. So long as Enesis and partition remained at the end of the road, that was not possible. Well, that message was put aside for a time, but then in the Macmillan plan, the British reverted to it, and that formed, I think, perhaps our most notable contribution to the eventual resolution of the problem, insofar as it ever was resolved.
During this two-year period, had there been any Turkish violence, Turkish Cypriot violence?
Yes, there had been some. To begin with, Eoka certainly made its target the British rather than the Turks, but inevitably in a situation like that with mixed population, with Turks serving in the police and the civil service and so on, some of them got killed, and then the extremism, the violence and so on the part of Eoka naturally produced a corresponding reaction from the Turks. But it wasn't until later that the prime target of Eoka became the Turks rather than the British. Even that is perhaps an exaggeration, but certainly later on the conflict between Greeks and Turks became a dominating feature.
Had any of the Turkish organisations, the terrorist organisations, been set up at this time?
Yes, I think it was in 1957. I'm not sure. that the TMT, which was the Turkish counterpart of EOKA, was set up. But I'd really want to check the the date there.
Do you think that at the end of the Field Marshal's period in 1957, that the strategic factor had changed regarding Cyprus?
Yes, I think it was during the period of 1957 that the British perhaps belatedly came round to the view that, after all, it wasn't absolutely necessary to have the whole of Cyprus as a base, but that bases in Cyprus would suffice. But certainly they came to that conclusion, perhaps reluctantly. Certainly the chiefs of staff, I think, were not very happy about it, and it was more of a political decision. And in any case, it was a contingent or hypothetical position, because quite obviously bases in Cyprus would not be very much use if the whole island was in turmoil and strife, because it wasn't only a question of the sovereign bases as they now exist at the Calais and Episcopi, but there were a fairly considerable number of minor installations all over the island which had to be maintained and defended. If civil war or something like that were going on in the island, it really would have been very difficult to operate these installations. So there had really to be a settlement of the conflict before the concept of British bases being sufficing for British defence purposes really became a reality.
Did you find that a change in the leadership during this emergency period, although you have explained how things had quietened down at the end of 57, nonetheless, for somebody like yourself in your position, was it difficult to have a change at top level?
Yes, well, one certainly felt the change in command and in style of command. The Field Marshal had concentrated on the security task and the restoration of law and order, and as I think I've said, he felt that it was his prime duty to bring violence to an end, and that this was in the interests of Cyprus as well as everybody else. Things had moved by the time Foot arrived, and the British government's choice of Foot obviously meant that they felt the time had come for a more political approach to the problem, and in many ways Foot, with his connections with the Labour Party and his very distinguished record as a colonial administrator, was a very good choice. Harding had completed the 2 years that he'd undertaken to serve, and the British government had to look round for somebody else to take his place. As I've said, Foote seemed to be a very good choice. Among other things, he knew a little of the island because he'd served there as colonial secretary at the end of the war period. I think he'd been there perhaps a couple of years, and had, I think, been very popular, and his reputation stood high in the island.
Of course, you had worked with him, as you have explained, very closely, had you not?
Yes, I worked closely with him at that time, as I think I said, as Secretary for Development and also as Secretary of the Executive Council. Well, he certainly brought great gifts and advantages to the job, and I don't think anybody would dispute that at that time we should move towards no, it isn't fair to say towards, because of course the Field Marshal had always quite clearly understood that a political rather than a military a solution was required, and he'd strived very, very hard for that. But perhaps a more political approach, I think, was felt to be timely at that period. Foote made a great impact when he arrived. He obviously had his own ideas, and to some extent they were preconceived ideas, which, as I'll explain in a moment, alarmed some of his advisers a bit. He set about trying a policy of reconciliation, which meant, of course, conciliation towards the Greeks, because at that stage the Turks were still more or less with us. And so almost immediately on his arrival, he made a number of conciliatory gestures, like releasing detainees, calling on the mayor of Nicosia, which was an unusual thing for a governor to do. It would normally be the other way about, visiting Greek churches and lighting candles there, and then going round the villages. It all had an impact, and people said, particularly in this country, what remarkable courage he was showing then. Well, of course, he is a very courageous man, but really the truth was that at that stage nobody, not even General Grievous, would have taken a pot shot at him, because they wanted to see what he'd come out with.
Did you back this policy? Were you happy about it at the time, this conciliatory policy of his?
No, I think his advisers were generally cautious, if not discouraging, about the ideas he brought with him. And certainly I was myself, and had much discussion with him about it. One of the difficulties in discussing the Foote plan is that no official version of it has ever been published. In his autobiography, he says it really consisted of four essentials. There was the return of Archbishop Makarios, the ending of the emergency, representative a government, and a final decision on the status of the island to be taken only with the agreement of the Greeks and Turks. Well, as far as my memory goes, that isn't quite how he presented it to us when he first arrived. My memory may be at fault, or again, the plan itself may have been modified a good deal, particularly in London, in discussions with ministers, before it was finally presented. As I recall it, the evening he arrived, he summoned his advisers to Government House and told us that he'd come armed with a plan, and that he'd got the essentials of it agreed in principle with ministers before he came, and that he would go ahead with this unless anyone could convince him that it wasn't right. And he then went on to say that it was essential that a solution should be based on the universally accepted principle of self-determination. Well, that took some of us aback a bit, because we had been under the impression that we'd been trying to apply self-determination to the difficult problem of Cyprus for the preceding three years. But then he went on to say that there should be a relatively short transitional period, which might be 5 or perhaps 7 years, and that the British government should reaffirm the Lennox-Boyd a statement on a separate communal self-determination, the one he made in December 1956 in the House of Commons. That isn't specifically stated in his own very brief summary of the proposals. He simply says that no final status should be decided without the agreement of Greeks and Turks, which may amount to more or less the same thing, but it wasn't quite how he put it to us at the time. Then there were to be three essential points. The problem of the Turkish minority was to be solved before the application of self-determination. Well, that was odd because it, and certainly if those words had ever appeared in any plan, it would have very gravely upset the Turks, because it appears to be reverting to the idea of the Turks as a mere minority who could be satisfied with minority safeguards, allowing the Greek majority still to vote Cyprus into union with Greece. And it suggests that their problem was to be settled before the application of self-determination. That presumably means by other means than self-determination. Well, if that was what he had in mind, obviously it was well calculated to upset the Turks. Then there were to be British bases or NATO bases, possibly including a Turkish base. And then finally, there were to be representative institutions during the interval before self-determination was applied. Well, that, as I recall it, was the essence of the plan as he put it to us, and certainly I made a note of it at the time, and that served as a basis for discussion with Foote and with the deputy governor and myself in a couple of papers which the Foreign Office have seen before publication. They raised no objection. Doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that they endorsed the summary as correct. But clearly there is some difference, as I've said, between the four essentials that Foote mentions in his autobiography and this summary of what I understood the plan to consist of at that stage. That was the day of his arrival. Well, he'd come armed with this plan, framed in the light of his experience 12 years previously as colonial secretary in really very different circumstances, because Cyprus at the end of the war was a very tranquil happy, in many ways, happy place. There must in the end obviously have been much more in the so-called Foote plan, as it was eventually presented to the Turks, than simply a broad statement of principles or essentials. Foote himself records in his book that when he went to Ankara with Selwyn Lloyd to try it on the Turks, they were very roughly treated by the Turks, particularly by the Turkish Foreign Minister Zorlu, and he describes how Zorlu picked up the document and just flicked through the pages of it and threw it on one side without even reading it. Well, that suggests it must have been a rather more substantial document than just the four essentials that I've mentioned. Well, I think those of the governor's advisors, pretty well that covers everybody, but of course it was mainly the people concerned with the political side rather than the security side who were involved in this discussion. I think pretty well all of them felt hesitation, doubts about this this plan, not because they were opposed to a policy of conciliation, provided it didn't make matters worse, and not because they were opposed to the principle of self-determination. Nobody was. It was just a question of how in the world to apply this difficult, awkward principle. Nor were they, of course, were they motivated by partisanship for the Turkish Cypriots and Turkey. But during the preceding 3 years, when they'd had to grapple with the harsh realities of political extremism and violence in Cyprus, they'd gradually come round to the view, as I've explained, that the only way ahead really was to try and rule out self-determination in the form of enesis and partition in advance, and then hope to reach a compromise. So it seemed disquieting to see British policy apparently reverting to the vain pursuit for self-government within the framework of conflicting promises of self-determination. And I think that was the main point that was seized on. And then there was I think everybody expressed grave apprehension about the probable Turkish reaction to these proposals. That again was a reasonable apprehension. Foote himself said that he felt pretty confident that he could square the Turks and put it through with them, and of course that was up to him. Then there was also the Greek reaction. You see, any reaffirmation of the Dennis Boyd's statement on separate self-determination was bound to provoke a very bad reaction from the Greek Cypriots, particularly after their hopes had been raised by the governor's conciliatory gestures on his arrival. I think really the plan was very different from the approach embodied in the Macmillan plan, though Foote himself has said he doesn't think there was all that much difference between them. But the difference to my mind was in principle, his was based on the sanctity of the idea of self-determination, whereas the Macmillan plan, as we'll see later, was based on the substitution of something different for self-determination as it's ordinarily understood, the substitution of a different method of satisfying the national aspirations of the Greek and Turkish Cypriots.
Bearing in mind that, you know, there was a team of very able advisers in government in Cyprus, did Hugh Foote listen to you? You know, would he debate these things and listen to what you had to say?
Well, to begin with, he did seem to have his mind completely made up about what he was going to do, and he didn't give much impression of being ready to listen to other advice. At the time when he disclosed his plan at Government House, he said at the end this was it, unless anybody had got something better to suggest. So some of us did then pick that up at once. Of course, it's not very easy talking just off the cuff, but picked it up and said we thought that there was indeed a better approach, namely that which Harding had moved towards in the last year of his governorship. Naturally, we didn't mention Harding by name, but I think one of the odd things about Foote's approach was that anybody normally coming into that tangled situation, the first thing he would do, the first thing I would do, would be to call for the documents of the previous period, see what my predecessor had tried to do, and so on, and learn from the mistakes. And even if one strongly disapproved of what had been done, it would be a useful educational exercise to see it anyway. Not so Foote, as far as I know, he never attempted to open the record and read what Harding had been attempting to do on the political plane. I think he'd probably come with a preconceived idea, as many people had, that Harding had simply been concerned with the military security situation, hadn't got anything useful to contribute on the political plane. But I may be doing him maybe doing Foote an injustice there. That was certainly my impression. Well, then, after the collapse of his plan, the debacle in Ankara and the violent Turkish riots which ensued, possibly instigated from Ankara, and then the alarming deterioration in relations between the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots, which ensued, then he did, I think, turn much more to some of his advisers, including myself, and discuss things very frankly with us. But throughout the whole period, he, and this, I think, is in his character, he wanted to keep the control of everything very much in his own hands, and also played his hand very close to his chest. It wasn't easy for even the people who were working closely with him always to know what he really had in mind and what he was recommending to ministers in London. That was a difficulty, but certainly he continued to treat me with great kindness and to show interest in what I had to suggest, and we got on well together. And at various stages, particularly at the birth of the Macmillan plan, no, from there on. So then he did show a much greater readiness to discuss and listen to advice. open way.